Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Your whim, all of my defenses down. Your camera looks through me with its x-ray vision, and all systems underground. All I can manage to push from my lips is a stream of absurdity. Every word I intended to speak winds up locked in a
Right there, dear listeners, it does bring us into the start of this morning's session of my Sunday morning take. Good morning, good morning, good morning, definitely good morning. I can barely feel my kneecaps, but good morning. Obviously because the cold is doing its thing, being cold, as always. And obviously, as we are very close, about a week out from winter, actually setting in, I do hope that you are keeping yourself warm, that you've at least got a warm brew in your hand somewhere, not like Dwight, who's without a warm brew of any kind. And ultimately, welcoming you to a Sunday, which it's not the final Sunday of the month, to be exact, because my suspicion is next Sunday will still be also, yeah, there is still one more Sunday of May left in terms of, you know, just counting. That's all, for pure counting. But as we always do here on my Sunday morning take, dear listeners, we get into the interesting, the weird, the not reportable, or that probably because it has happened already in many cases, specifically from the historical dimension, as well as also looking into the very interesting aspect in terms of when actually did we start, you know, or when did us as humanity actually start taking notice of the various subjects that we've had so far here on my Sunday morning take. Now, this morning session specifically gets us looking at oil and when was the first actual instance that we actually heard about the uses of oil, the thing taken out of the ground, you know, petroleum, that particular product. And how far back has history actually looked at, you know, the usage, the adoption, the various particular products that existed at the time, the needs that were met with the product at the time, and what did it look like back then? Obviously, it's a little bit difficult to have actual pictures of, let's for example say, way back with the, you know, with the ancient civilizations from the reading that I did yesterday. But it seems like it was a regular product for certain particular uses, specifically for heating and specifically to have like access to lighting. When I say lighting, I'm talking about, you know, the ability to have oil for a lamp so that you can switch on a lamp at home. You know, old school stuff, you know, without electricity, before electricity, you know, those stuff. So yeah, it seems like that was the fundamental, need, you know, to have lighting. And then secondly, in certain civilizations, it became the resource for heating and, ensuring that, you know, during winter, the various civilizations kept themselves warm. And no, it's not even on the sophisticated level like what I've explained back on Friday on the home run with Helmut regarding, for example, what you would see in Siberia, in what is now known as, but not Russia's most northernmost city or town. That's a different place, but which is technically in the coldest part of Russia, that being Siberia, is the city of Yakutia or Yakutsk. In the zone or the area of Yakutia, where they actually do get, it's that city and the eastern city, the one on the Pacific Ocean side, Vladivostok. Those two cities reach levels of, okay, Yakutia gets colder than Vladivostok. Yakutia can at least reach a temperature of minus 70 degrees Celsius during its coldest part of its winter. Vladivostok itself can reach a temperature of close to 30 degrees Celsius during its coldest part of its winter. But because Vladivostok is literally a coastal city, and primarily that it's very difficult sometimes also to freeze over an ocean. I mean, it would have to be very cold for that to happen. The indications obviously between Vladivostok, which sits a little bit higher than Yakutia, and if you had to draw a line in terms of what they call it, a not a longitudinal but a latitude line,
across Russia and try to see who sits actually higher than the other, you'd probably find that they might be the same height in terms of their positioning geographically. Not height in terms of on a hill or stuff like that. No, just in terms of who sits higher in terms of a latitude line across Russia. But then you get the interesting indicators, obviously, like places like Tasmania in Australia and New Zealand themselves, Patagonia, the whole of Patagonia, which is southern Chile / Argentina. They have their interesting cold areas. Obviously, they don't experience the excessive coldness like the northern hemisphere does, because there's a lot more people in the northern hemisphere than there is people in the southern hemisphere. And the southern hemisphere is not to be confused with the global south label that we've used interchangeably here on Eagle FM, because the global south includes everyone outside Europe and North America. I'll say it again. Everyone outside Europe and North America. And Japan as well, and South Korea, and Australia, and New Zealand. Everyone outside those zones would be deemed as the global south. So, oil has been there, but oil has actually got a way deeper history with humanity than what we think it has. In this morning's discussion, we take a look at as how far back has oil been present in humanity's role specifically, or actually in, while humanity has obviously been setting its civilization, setting its cities, building its walls, doing its various particular activities, going to war, trying to find stable sources of income and food, obviously, and also dealing with the various, climatic and geographic elements, threats, and severe anomalies. For example, like earthquakes, like what the city of Pompeii had to experience. But when you have to look at the role that oil has played, oil has always been there. It would be picked up in historical texts, it'd be outlined specifically in the needs that were met with the product in those historical texts, and for how long. Now we've got to start off firstly with the overall need. Not the need basically, but more like the identifying of how far back things actually go. Now, this is the Environmental Agency of the United States, the EIA. They've got this lovely little explainer, which is indicated in a timeline of oil's particular or petroleum's particular uses, or let me rather say the first instances in terms of where humanity has actually used petroleum itself. Now it goes back as far back as 3000 BC, then 2000 BC, from 600 to 700 AD to 1750 to the mid 1800s to 1859, 1890s, 1920, from 1950 to present, from 1960 to here, 1970, 72, 73, 73, and so it continuously goes on in terms of showing the major events, but much of it is from an American perspective. But I'll just highlight to you the ones that actually end in more like a global initiative. At 3000 BC, the Mesopotamians of the era used rock oil for architectural adhesives to help with the manufacturing or the construction of their ships, which in shipping corks, and to produce medicines, and also in road construction, meaning bitumen. By 2000 BC, the Chinese refined crude oil for use in lighting and heating. By 600 to 700 AD, The Arab and Persian chemists had discovered that petroleum's lighter elements could be mixed with quicklime to make Greek fire. So that's where Greek fire comes from. Oh my goodness. All right. Which is today known as the napalm of its day. By 1750, a French military officer noted that Indians living near Fort Duquesne, which is now the site of Pittsburgh, set fire to an oil-slicked creek as part of a religious ceremony. As settlement by Europeans proceeded, oil was discovered in many places in northwestern Pennsylvania, now the United States, and western New York, to the frequent dismay of the well owners who were drilling for salt brine. And by the mid-1800s, expanding uses for oil extracted from coal and shale began to hint at the value of rock oil, encouraging the search for readily accessible supplies. By 1859, oil was first discovered when a homemade rig drilled down at least 70 feet, which is a couple of meters, and came up coated with oil. This rig was near Titusville, which is now in northwestern Pennsylvania, and it was owned by Edwin Drake. That's in the United States. In the 1890s, mass production of automobiles began creating demand for gasoline. Before this, kerosene used for heating had been the main oil product. By 1920, with 9 million automobiles in the United States, gas stations were opening up everywhere. From 1950 up to present, with the growing use of automobiles, oil became the Earth's most used energy source. 1960, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, was formed by Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. The group has since grown to 11 members up to date. Obviously, with the latest development being that the UAE obviously now is trying to sever those ties. By 1970, production of petroleum, which is crude oil and natural gas plant liquids in the United States, lower 48 states, reached its highest level of 9.4 million barrels per day. Production of these, production in these states had been declining ever since 1970. 1972, oil well productivity for the nation received, that's now the United States, a high of 18.6 barrels per day per well, which is, you know, sounds very, you know, very productive. And by 1973, the Arab oil embargo, which is when several Arab OPEC nations embargoed or stopped selling oil to the United States and Holland to protest their support of Israel in the Arab-Israeli Yom Kippur War. Later on, the Arab OPEC nations added South Africa, Rhodesia, and Portugal to the list of countries that were embargoed, and Arab OPEC production was cut by 25%, causing some temporary shortages and the tripling of oil prices. Some filling stations back then ran out of gasoline, and cars had to wait in long lines for said gasoline. Now, in reaction to the 1973 embargo, the U.S. Congress at the time passed laws that tried to protect consumers from gasoline shortages and high prices. The price controls of the Emergency Petroleum Allocation Act of 1973 were generally considered a failure, and they were later on repealed. By 1975, the U.S. Congress once again passed the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975, which was aimed at increasing oil production by giving price incentives. This act also created the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for the United States and required an increase in the fuel efficiency, meaning the kilometers per liter or the miles per gallon. Well, miles per gallon is, a gallon is pretty strong. So a gallon, I think, contains like 3 or 5 liters. In specifically this new development to be applied to cars. And then 1978 to 1980, the Iranian Revolution, which began in late 1978, resulted in a drop of 3.9 million barrels per day of crude oil production from Iran between 1978 to 1981. And at first, other OPEC countries made up for the drop in Iranian production. But in 1980, the Iran-Iraq war also began, and many Persian Gulf countries reduced output as well. By 1981, OPEC production was about one-fourth lower than it had been in 1978, and prices had doubled. By 1980 to 85, OPEC kept prices high by producing less oil. Saudi Arabia acted as a swing producer, cutting more production than any other OPEC country. But higher prices caused less oil to be used. For example, cars became smaller, using less petroleum, losing less petrol. The drop in oil consumption meant that less oil needed was needed to be produced. Thus, the oil production from Saudi Arabia fell from 9.9 million barrels per day in 1980 to 3.4 million barrels per day by 1985. Then, obviously, some of the particular key developments that took place, which are predominantly political, skipping just over the American and the last Saudi Arabia involvement. By 1988, the United States state, Alaska, their production at Prudhoe Bay peaked at 2 million barrels per day and fell to 1 million barrels per day in 1999. By then, U.S. total output had dropped to 7.8 million barrels per day, which was 31% below its peak. Obviously, 1990 to 1991, the Iraq war happened with the Iraq invasion of Kuwait happened, which obviously led to the first Iraq war taking place. And then finally, just heading into the aspect in terms of the recent developments, by 2010, that by 20 April 2010, an explosion and fire occurred on the offshore drilling rig known as Deepwater Horizon, which had been drilling an exploratory well in the Gulf of Mexico. They're actually mentioning the Gulf of America here. The accident actually killed 11 crew members and left oil leaking from the unfinished well into the ocean for months. By 27 May 2010, the Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, at the time, announced a six-month hold or moratorium on deep water drilling. Now, that sets the scene specifically of the developments and some of the earliest uses. In the second half of this morning's particular programming, I'll get into, the significance specifically of Iran. There is two interesting pieces right here about their significance, but we've actually got to look at the first known particular cases of petroleum and its discovery and its particular uses. Now, petroleum was discovered in the early times by observing natural oil seeps and later on extracted through drilling efforts as technology advanced. So, I'll explain to you now. Back in 2022, we had natural oil seeps. We still have natural oil seeps. And the whole discussion about drilling so far out at sea is looking more and more like it's just happening out there at sea. Another indication from this obviously had been it would have been easier to work with oil exploration on land than with oil exploration in the sea. I'll say it again. It would have been easier to work with oil exploration on land than with oil exploration offshore in the sea. If you don't know, we would have had the oil actually flowing a lot quicker. Investment decisions would have happened 2 years ago at least. And in many scenarios, the discussion would have advanced Namibia's particular economic position. Now, historically, what historians have identified is that natural oil seeps are where literally where the surface and literally where the reserve are the closest to be seen with the naked eye. We still have those things. We still have it. Now, since natural oil seeps have been the most obvious identifiable, if I can call it sort of like natural phenomena or natural occurrence by which ancient civilizations had observed and had actually had access to the particular resource itself, the natural oil seeps, and later on being extracted through the drilling efforts as the technology advanced, ancient civilizations, which included the Sumerians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, noticed oil seeping to the surface as tar-like deposits or as thin films of oil on water bodies. This has been present ever since. They utilized crude oil and bitumen, which was collected from these seeps, for various purposes, such as medicine and for construction. Such natural oil seeps were the first indicators of a petroleum's presence beneath the Earth's surface. However, it was not until the mid-19th century, which is technically here in the 1800s, that the potential of petroleum was a significant energy source, and this was when it was recognized. The first well specifically drilled for oil using mechanized technology was completed by Edwin Drake in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania. The success of this well, strategically placed near a known oil seep, marked the beginning of the modern petroleum industry, as it demonstrated that oil could be extracted in large quantities from underground reserves. Now, we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners. From the musical break, we'll come back and head into the rest of this morning's program, where we'll be looking at some of the other historical examples in terms of heating, as well as also keeping the lights on, specifically whereby the products itself and some of the earliest, you know, sets of information identified where petroleum was actually, what it was used for, how it actually was identified, and some of the particular known historical texts that explain different uses of the time.
It was just after midnight when she looked me in the eye. Said, you fancy a gunfight? Come and meet me outside. She walks like an angel. She's the devil in white. I can only follow when I should run for my life. In my heart, always it was her in the dark, cause it's true. I fall hard, and I don't wanna let her know. I know how the story goes. It's written on the wall, I've seen it all before. The hunger when she calls, I begged and I borrowed just to hide from the light. I'm lost in this battle, I'm out of my mind. It was all I could stay for, just to keep me alive. I'm drowning my sorrows, cause she's soon out of sight. In my heart, always it was her in the dark, cause it's true. Story goes, it's written on the wall, I've seen it all before, the hunger when she calls. My heart won't understand why there's bloodstains on her hands. She says, don't go kill her. She says, don't go kill her.
My heart won't understand why there's bloodstains on her hands. She says, don't call me love.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat oder spare noch mehr mit unserem speziellen Abonnement-Plänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
Yeah.
Coming back there from the sounds of New Guinea with the song Gelby. And before that was a little bit of St. Raymond with the song Killer. And that ultimately brings us up about 10 minutes to the top of the hour, specifically as we head, we're close to the midway point specifically. Now, where we left off, dear listeners, getting into some more historical context, obviously, in terms of the particular early history uses of petroleum. Now, I mentioned to you a little bit earlier about some of the things from the ancient civilizations and obviously into ancient China, but also getting specifically into what the ancient Greeks also used it for is another interesting thing as well. Now, according to the Greek philosopher, one of the other Greek philosophers or historian, he was actually an ancient Greek historian and geographer, Herodotus. Herodotus indicated that more than 4,000 years ago, natural asphalt was employed in the construction of walls and in the towers of Babylon. Now, he indicated that great quantities of the asphalt were found on the banks of the river Issus, which is one of the tributaries of the Euphrates, which is discovered also, which also runs through modern-day Iraq. This fact was confirmed by another Greek historian and ancient historian, specifically Diodorus Siculus, where Herodotus also mentioned that pitched spring, which is another product also of petroleum, not product that you manufacture, but it's another form shows up in, that pitched spring on the Zacynthus. Zacynthus is an island today known as Ionia in modern-day Greece. And Herodotus also described a well for bitumen, which is the very thick oil, and oil near Arderica in Chesia. In ancient China, petroleum was used more than 2,000 years ago, where in one of the ancient texts of China, known as the I Ching, or you can, when you have to pronounce it technically, you'll read it as the Yi Ching, you know, the one Ching. Because Yi means one, just so that you guys know. One of the earliest Chinese writings is that cites the use of oil in its raw state without refining was first discovered, extracted, and used in China in the 1st century BC. In addition to this, Chinese were the first to use petroleum as fuel as early as the 4th century BC. The earliest known gas wells were drilled in China in AD 347, or even earlier, and they had depths of up to 800 feet, which was about 240 meters, and were drilled using bits attached to bamboo poles. Now, the gas was burned to evaporate brine and to produce salt. By the 10th century, extensive bamboo pipelines connected gas wells with salt springs. The ancient records of China and Japan are also said to contain many allusions to the use of natural gas for lighting and heating, and petroleum was known as burning water in Japan in the 7th century. In the book, The Dream Pool Essays, written in 1088, yes, in the year 1088, a Chinese scientist and statesman at the time, Shen Kuo, of the Song Dynasty, coined the word rock oil. I almost said little rock. Coined the word rock oil, which in the scripture as it is written, shi yo, for the petroleum, which remains the term used in contemporary Chinese and Japanese till today. The actual word used in Japanese is sekiyu, so as to identify petroleum's actual name, rock oil, in that language, and it obviously highlights that where the thing actually comes from. The first streets of ancient Baghdad were paved with tar, which was derived from petroleum that became accessible from natural fields in the region. In the 9th century, oil fields were exploited in the area around modern Baku, in Azerbaijan back then. These fields were described by the Arab geographer Abu al-Hasan Ali al Masudi in the 10th century and by Marco Polo in the 13th century when Marco Polo traveled with his, I think it's with his father or his uncle on the way to the east, who described the output of these wells as hundreds of shiploads. Now, through Islamic Spain, that, if you did not know, Spain was Islamic up to a certain point, distillation became available in Western Europe by the 12th century. It has also been present in Romania since the 13th century, being recorded as Pacura. Now, originally, other various forms of the terms nafta, which is N-A-P-H-T-A, or asphalt, and bitumen, were used for the liquid and solid forms of petroleum. Now, the origin of the term petroleum stems from monasteries in southern East Italy, where it was in use by the end of the first millennium as an alternative for the older term nafta. Now, for the volatile forms of hydrocarbons, which are now known as methane or natural gas, terms came only in use during the 17th century and later on. So this also means the words, how we identify the item today, where these words come from, what do they signal, and who were the origins of these particular introductions of these new terminologies. Now, the earliest mention of petroleum in the Americas occurs when a gentleman by the name of Walter Raleigh, his account of the Trinidad Pitch Lake in 1595, while 37 years later on, the account of a visit of a Franciscan, whose name was Joseph de la Roche de Allion, to the oil springs of New York was published in Gabriel Sagard's Histoire du Canada. A Finnish-born Swede, a scientist and a student by the name of Carl Linnaeus, Peter Kalm, in his work Travels into North America, published first in 1753, showed on a map the oil springs of Pennsylvania. By 1710 or 1711, this is now by another Russian-born Swiss physician and Greek teacher, known as Irene de Irenaeus. It seems that the who first discovered asphaltum at Val de Travers or Neuchâtel specifically, indicated that specifically the bitumen that he established, a bitumen mine, which was established in 1719 that operated until 1986. Now, some of the earliest forms, as you can obviously see here, also leads into various other parts. For example, like within Russia, we see that oils in 1745 under the Russian Empress Elizabeth, the first oil well and refinery was built in Ukhta by Fyodor Priadonov through the process of distillation of the rock oil, petroleum. The indication of this was that he received a kerosene-like substance which was used in oil lamps by Russian churches and monasteries, and even though households also still relied on candles, but it also moved in there, specifically in ancient China and ancient Japan. With oil sands, which were mined in 1745 in Merkweiler Pechelbronn in Alsace-Lorraine, or in the province, in the area of Alsace, which is between Germany and France. If you don't know about Alsace-Lorraine and its particular significant historical, historical significance, is that it's one of the reasons as to why the failed Austrian painter also started the Second World War. Well, because, okay, Alsace is on the French side. On the other side of the river, you find, I think it's the Rhineland. It's a specific geographic territory in Germany. Now, both Alsace and the Rhineland are rich in that part of Europe, with certain natural deposits itself, like you heard right now. But the key thing has been, obviously, with reference to the after effects of the First World War, and which led to the effects of the Second World War was that the French and the British technically wanted, you know, a united Germany after the First World War to pay reparations for starting the First World War. But how they did it was to go in to literally take hold and occupy your industrial producing areas, thus depriving you from being able to pay, but they are still extracting from what is being produced right there. So, the oil sands that were mined in 1745 or from 1745 in Merkweiler Peschelbronn in Alsace under direction of Louis-Pierre Anselon de la Sablonnière. Wow, what a name. This is obviously by a special appointment of the French king at the time, Louis the 15th. The Peschelbronn oil field was active until 1970, and it was the birthplace of the companies like Antar and Schlumberger. The first modern refinery was also built in 1857. Now, with all that ancient history in terms of ancient adoptions and for how long this particular product has been between us humans, obviously you're seeing that most of it was in the northern hemisphere of life. I feel so sad for us in the southern hemisphere, meaning we have no recollection. We had no recollection specifically of how we used oil or petroleum here in the southern hemisphere, which clearly also indicates a distinct disadvantage with this resource, because we have no known history in the southern hemisphere. When I say the southern hemisphere, I'm not talking about the whole of Africa. I'm talking about literally the equator that runs through the DRC below the equator. That includes us, Namibia. We don't have a history of working with the thing. But we hope to change that particular picture. I say we hope. Not on the high seas, but just, you know, wherever we are. So, starting off also, as we reach the midway point and we take another short musical break, we will be getting into the modern history components, obviously. The ones that primarily look at developments in oil extraction from the 1800s heading this way. Some of the particular fields, some of the particular products, some of the particular developments, and some of the more, which is now relevant technologies, but some of the more important aspects in terms of highlighting what we've seen so far. And on that note, dear listeners, we'll be back right after this.
Don't. people work for fun. Girl, I just work for you. They told me marriage was a give and take. Well, you show me you can take. You got some giving to do. And
Right there were the Jefferson Airplane with the song Somebody to Love. Obviously it's not Valentine's Day, guys. Just citing that. And specifically, welcoming you back to the My Sunday Morning Take, where we've obviously looked at the first half in terms of the historical uses and how long has oil or petroleum been part of our particular lives. I'm talking about everybody, but also many other particular, you know, instances across the world. And also specifically looking at the, you know, the various uses that it was applied in back then. However, it then allows us the next particular opportunity to look into the modern day uses and the modern day developments that we obviously now see springing forward, because it seems that petroleum manifests, manifests in certain scenarios across the world. So we're talking about natural oil seepage, seeping through the ground upwards, where you can actually visibly see it, seeping into water bodies so that it's naturally visible on bodies of water like lakes, rivers, being certain kinds of products like, you know, it's contained within rocks or rock formations. And secondly, that it can be at has various other particular applications, like, or that it also has the gas associated to it, which we all discovered literally 4 years back, that if you find the one, you will know that the other is there. So, which is pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. Now, in the, if we call it now the modern day uses since the 1800s, the modern day uses itself, have provided for some, you know, in terms of setting the scene in terms of how the oil has now been extracted, or the particular product itself has now been been extracted for the past 100 plus years. If we can make it, it probably is like 200 years by now. Almost 200 years, because if we set it at the 1847 standard, or, yeah, the 1847 standard would probably be 200 years by now. So, modern history sees the particular first occurrence or discovery of coal oil. Now, the modern history of petroleum began in the 19th century with the refining of paraffin from crude oil. The Scottish chemist James Young in 1847 noticed a natural petroleum seepage in the Riddings Colliery of Alfreton in Derbyshire, from which he distilled a light, thin oil suitable for use as lamp oil, which is paraffin, at the same time obtaining a thicker oil suitable for lubricating machinery. Now, the new oils were successful. The new oils were successful, but the supply of oil from the coal mine soon began to fail, eventually being exhausted in 1851. Young, noticing that the oil was dripping from the sandstone roof of the coal mine, theorized it somehow originated from the action of heat on the coal seam, and from this thought that it might be produced artificially, hence the coal oil suggestion. Now, following up on this idea, Young then tried many experiments and eventually succeeded by distilling cannel coal at a low heat, which is a fluid resembling petroleum, which when treated in the same way as the seep oil gave similar products. Young found that by slow distillation he could obtain a number of useful liquids from it, one of which he named paraffin oil, because at low temperatures it congealed into a substance resembling paraffin wax. The production of these oils and the solid paraffin wax from coal formed the subject of his patent dated 17 October 1850. In 1850, Young and Meldrum and Edward William Binney entered into partnership under the title of E. W. Binney and Company at Bathgate in West Lothian, which is obviously in Scotland or somewhere in Northern America, and E. Meldrum and Company at Glasgow. Their works at Bathgate were completed in 1851, and it became the first truly commercial oil works and oil refinery in the world. using oil extracted from locally mined turbinite, or torbinite, not turbo, torbinite. Torbinite, just so that you also know about this, dear listeners, is a specific name for basically the coal. Turbinite, it's if you see it, it doesn't look black. It's not black. It's technically brownish in color. So turbinite, also known as boghead coal or kerosene shale, is a variety of fine-grained black oil shale. It usually occurs as lenticular masses, often associated with deposits of Permian coals. So it's basically a kind of a deposit that has to, if you see the other one, that you usually find it close by, the turbinate, or the torbinate, should I rather say. Now, obviously when this particular turbinate, the locally mined turbinate, the shale and the bituminous coal were extracted, they were used to manufacture the naphtha that, you know, we heard about a little bit earlier. That's the other name specifically for the flammable liquid hydrocarbon mixture. Generally, it is a fraction of crude oil, but it can also be produced from natural gas condensates, petroleum distillates, and the fractional distillation of coal tar and peat. And in some industries and regions, the name naphtha refers to crude oil or refined, you know, in a way, refined petroleum in a sense. Now, you heard there that it sometimes comes from peat, naphtha. When we did the fossil bodies that we've discovered all across the world, the oldest fossilized human remains, well, yeah, okay, if I say fossilized, it's a little bit weird, but you could also say a little bit, you could also use the word preserved. Now, peat, which is this one particular kind of a natural substance found specifically in certain parts of the world, peat is the particular preservative that has allowed for example, history's bog bodies. They call them bog bodies. So these were people that died either through ritualistic killings, or they were either murdered in some cases. If you look them up, we had the discussion here earlier this year, back in last month, actually, not this month, regarding the bog bodies that have been discovered across the world, specifically mostly in Europe. The bog bodies resemble, firstly, the scientific indicators were what preserves the bodies of these people so well. And secondly, you know, under what conditions did the people meet their demise? And it's one of these fascinating things of history where they apply, you know, the technology as well as also, you know, a lot of theories just run wild from the discovery itself, which technically is a question of asking, you know, under what conditions, for how long has this person been here? What were the particular circumstances that they met their demise, and what do they look like? First and most important question that they usually asked was, what do they look like, and could they find evidence of who this person potentially was? Fascinating stuff in terms of an archaeological perspective. Interesting stuff in terms of understanding specifically how far back you can actually discover human remains. And no, if you're going to ask the question, do we have bogs in Africa or Southern Africa? No, we don't. It's way too dry. Bogs are a kind of swampy situation that you predominantly only find in Europe. It's a completely different thing from what you would find, for example, in North and Central America. The only places that have swamps, let me see, bogs in the world and swamps in the world, should obviously indicate to you the two different geographic locations where these things only occur. if you had to look at what a bog is a waterlogged, nutrient-poor wetland where dead plant matter accumulates as peat over thousands of years, millennia, over thousands of years. This dead plant material, hence the reason why crude oil or petroleum is viewed as dead plant and animal material that is just collected in certain deposits or caverns underneath the ground or pockets underneath the ground. Now, bogs. Oh, there is a Central African. There is a Central African bog. It's the Congo Basin peatlands. So the Congo Basin does have a bog. You get the Western Siberian lowlands. There's one in Southeast Asia. There's a North American one. And then there's a European one. But it has to meet certain conditions, meaning it must be wet. There must be a lot of abundant rainfall. And there must be a lot of abundant plant life around it. So, bogs are widely distributed in cold temperate climates, mostly in boreal ecosystems in the northern hemisphere, as I said, mostly in the northern hemisphere. If you had to look up swamps, you find a swamp in Siberia, you find a swamp in South America, you find a swamp in New Guinea. I don't know if it's Papua New Guinea specifically, but much of the swamps seem to be in the Americas, from North to South America. And it's one of the discussions, obviously, because swamps and bogs form part of the wetland discussion that Namibia is also trying to, you know, protect in its own right, because we do have wetlands. We do have wetlands. Very good wetland is specifically the whole of Zambezi into the Tukavango regions. I don't know if you can call the Fish River Canyon a wetland because it's technically dry, but the Fish River does flow. It does flow. There is a river. But the canyon itself, which is the second largest canyon on the surface of the earth, minus the Mariana Trench, the canyon itself, which is second only to the Grand Canyon in the United States, because the Grand Canyon is the biggest one on the planet, on the surface of the earth, specifically on dry land. And the Fish River Canyon itself, which is in Namibia, southern Namibia, it does have a river flowing through it, the Fish River. The downside is it's not a wetland. A wetland speaks literally to, a lot more rainfall and plant life being present versus it being slightly drier with the supply of the river, obviously, potentially coming through from the Orange River in an extent or to an extent. So, yeah, swamps, We don't see swamps easy, but we do have a lot of water specifically in certain scenarios, underground or otherwise on our borders, meaning the moving water situations or installations of the bodies. Another thing that also pops up is how we specifically look at the product itself in terms of, now getting back to the oil, the first instances of oil in human history. Since we're now in the modern history period of said particular oil usage. Now, kerosene, this is now after the discussion of what happened with the guy in Scotland and the first known particular commercial endeavor that was signed, sealed, and developed. The next particular major product that actually was produced in the 1800s of petroleum or oil, let me just rather use oil, was kerosene. Now, a gentleman by the name of Abraham Pineo Gesner, a Canadian geologist, developed a process to refine a liquid fuel from coal, bitumen, and oil shale. Now, his new discovery, which he then named kerosene, burned more cleanly and was less expensive than competing products such as whale oil. In 1850, Gesner created the Kerosene Gas Light Company and began installing lighting in the streets of Halifax, which is a city in Canada, and other cities. By 1858, he had expanded to the United States, where he created the North American Kerosene Gaslight Company at Long Island, New York. Demand grew to where his company's capacity to produce became a problem, but the discovery of petroleum, from which kerosene could be more easily produced, solved the supply problem. This led to another development, this now in the European context, specifically in Poland, where Ignacy Łukasiewicz improved Gesner's method to develop a means of refining kerosene from the more readily available rock oil, which is the petroleum. The rock oil seeps in 1852, and the first rock oil mine was built in Bobirka, near Krosno in central European Galicia, which is now known as Poland, in 1858. These discoveries rapidly spread around the world, and a gentleman by the name of Mirzhov, built the first modern Russian refinery in the mature oil fields of at Baku in 1861. And at that time, Baku in Azerbaijan produced about 90% of the world's oil. And this then leads us to the oil wells, because oil wells are also a kind of a resource, sort of like, what's the word? If you group it together, the resource grouping itself. But it's also a means of basically saying, hey, listen, this is now how us humans are literally drilling a little bit of a borehole to actually extract the thing. If you think about a borehole drilling scenario in its, you know, in its own entirety, because that's also how the oils, how the oil was specifically discovered in Saudi Arabia, was that there was a geology team who were on a contract by the Saudi king, the Saudi sultan, to basically go and drill for water in the desert. And what they discovered was they discovered oil when they started drilling. But I'll get there. Don't worry. Now, additionally, or specifically looking at the oil well discussion, is that the first commercial oil well, or what was thought to be, or is thought to be the first commercial oil well, is not entirely clear, and there was also no general consensus specifically on this description, because the following highlights from an observation from someone else known as Vasiliu, who noticed that Edwin Drake's 1859 well near Titusville in Pennsylvania is described as the more popularly considered example of the first modern well. Now, Drake's well is probably singled out because it was drilled, not dug, because it used a steam engine, because there was a company associated with it, and because it touched off a major boom of the same activity. Additionally, there was a considerable activity before Drake in various parts of the world in the mid-19th century, because in 1846, another candidate for consideration as the first modern oil well in the world was drilled in the South Caucasus region of the Russian Empire, which is now Azerbaijan, on the Apsheron Peninsula northeast of Baku. Now, this was done by a Russian major, Nikolai Medvedevich Alexeyev, who, based on the ideas and vision of another Nikolai by the name of Nikolai Ivanovich Voskobojnikov. Now, unlike Drake's well in Virginia, or unlike Drake's well, the 1846 Baku well was drilled using human and animal power and not an engine. There were engine-drilled wells in West Virginia in the same year as Drake's well, and an early commercial well was hand-dug in Poland in 1853. And another one in nearby Romania in 1857. Also, a well was drilled in 1857 to a depth of 280 feet, which is a couple of meters, by the American Merrimack Company in La Brea, which is now Spanish for pitch, in southeast Trinidad in the Caribbean. Refineries were also the next particular development that obviously had to be thought of, because you needed the industrial installation to actually work with the raw material. Unlike Namibia, which is still caught in the aspect of trying to promote local content policy, where we are trying to get businesses, young people, young business ideas, I say young business ideas, not young business people, just business ideas, which are new business ideas in terms of how to bridge certain gaps and certain and reach for certain opportunities, which are sometimes deemed as the low-hanging fruit scenario. The distillation of oil started halfway through the 18th century in small refineries that were called distilleries in the Ural, Galicia. This is now northwestern Ukraine. And in the Russian district of Mozdokhsky, which is near the city of Grozny, where the first oil refineries, primitive brick outline distilleries with a pot, were built and run by the Dubinin brothers in 1823. And specifically, since they still had, you know, feudal systems present then, there was obviously the identification of serfs who had prior experience in resin distillation that used to make pine tar. Now, during the first half of the 19th century, small refineries were also opened in Moravia, which is in now modern-day Czech Republic, or Czechia, as the new name of the country is. Galicia is the old name for Poland, France, and, Galicia and Poland basically just repeat itself. Now, the first large scale of these oil refineries were also opened at Jasło in Poland, with the largest one being opened at Ploiești in Romania. Now, built in 1856 and inaugurated in 57 by the two brothers, Teodor and Marin Mehedinteanu. Man, these European names. The Ravov refinery, the refinery built at Ploiești, had a surface area of about 4 hectares. In this particular refinery, the daily production reached at least 7 tons, which were obtained in cylindrical iron and iron casts that were heated by fire from wood. It was then called the world's first systematic oil distillery, setting the record for being the world's first oil refinery, and according to the Academy of World Records. Now, this refinery obtained on the basis of a contract that was concluded in October of 1856 between the one Mehedinteanu brother, that being Teodor, and the city hall of Bucharest, the exclusive right to supply the illumination of the Wallachian capital with lamp oil. The contract began to be executed on 1 April 1857, when, by replacing the kidnapped oil, I don't know why they used the word kidnapped, but the kidnapped oil with products supplied by the Ravov refinery. Now Bucharest became the first city in the world that was illuminated entirely with distilled crude oil. By 1857, the total production of Romania amounted to at least 275 tons of crude oil. With this figure, Romania was registered as the first country in the world with oil production statistics, before other large oil-producing states such as the United States, who started registering that in 1860, Russia in 1863, Mexico in 1901, and Persia in 1913. A good indicator of early petroleum production, for example, like from the United States side of things, they started taking records in 1859, where they highlighted that 2,000 barrels of oil were produced, which then led to a jump up from 1859, 10 years later, to 1869, to 4.2 million barrels a year. 1879, another 10 years, it jumped to 19.9 million barrels per year. 1889, 35.1 million barrels per year. 1899, 57 million barrels per year. And 1906, 126 million barrels per year. We'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners. We come back right after that, heading into the last quarter of this morning's programming on My Sunday Morning Take, here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And obviously, I do hope, guys, you've woken up with at least with a cup of coffee or something warm in your hands, specifically as we get through this chilly Sunday morning. But it is to be expected. We're this close to winter. We're this close to June. It's the midway point. We will obviously find ourselves, you know, trying to stay warm as much as possible during the coming months. But we'll be back after this musical break.
see what you're doing to me. When you don't believe a word I say, we can't go on together with suspicious. Say hello. Would I still see suspicion in your eyes? Here we go again, asking where I've been. You can't see the tears are real, I'm crying. We can't go suspicious minds, and we can build our dreams on suspicious minds. Oh, let our love survive, or dry the tears from your eyes. Let's don't let a good thing die. When, honey, you're doing to me. When you don't believe a word I say, why don't you know I'm caught in a trap? I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why don't you know I'm
coming back there with a little bit of, find myself singing a little bit here for no reason. But yeah, that is what we do here on the Sundays only, specifically on my Sunday Morning Take. Obviously, this is as we were looking at the ancient uses to the recent uses to the actual developments of petroleum products in humanity. And just like I stated a little bit earlier, just before the musical break, the last one, which was now, the unfortunate thing is, we don't have like the institutional slash, you know, national knowledge of using this product as much as what other parts of the world have been enjoying. Which is a little bit of a, a deprivation to an extent. And obviously, this is as developments since the 1800s into the 1900s started moving forward in terms of how oil was, you know, discovered. Now, I actually want to get to a interesting part of the particular role that the Middle East plays, like it does today, in our discussion, where the availability of oil and its access became sort of like a crucial element, or it became crucial in its entirety, specifically in military power and after World War One, particularly for navies as they changed from coal-powered engines to, obviously, you know, using, you know, the black gold known as fuel or oil, but also with the introduction of the motor transport, the tanks and the airplanes, specifically for the armies. Such thinking would continue into the later conflicts of the 20th century, specifically in World War II. And what I did not know, guys, and I think a lot of you also did not know, is there was actually an oil crisis before 1953. Okay, actually, okay, let me not say 1953. This has to do with Iran once again. So there was actually an oil crisis during the Second World War. Okay, not an oil crisis, because it actually happened after the Second World War, literally just a few years after the Second World War and before 1953. So what happened? I'll get to that explainer. But the important indication is, as literally as we understand the animosity that exists today is as a result of the Second World War. And as a result specifically of what the Soviets and the British did. It's the Soviets and the British that invaded Iran, back then known as Persia. But we're jumping the gun a little bit. Now, during specifically heading into the Second World War, where the oil facilities were a major strategic asset and were extensively bombed, in 1938, vast reserves of oil were discovered in the Al-Aqsa region in the eastern part of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia along the coast of the Arabian Gulf. Until the mid-1950s, coal was still the world's foremost fuel, but after this time, oil quickly took over. Later on, following the 1973 and 79 energy crises, there was significant media coverage on the subject of the oil supply levels. This also brought to light the concern that oil is a limited resource that will eventually run out, and at least as an economically viable energy source. Although at the time, the most common and popular predictions were quite dire, a period of increased production and reduced demand in the following years caused an oil glut in the 1980s. This was also not to last, however, and by the first decade of the 21st century, discussions about peak oil had actually returned back into the broader mainstream media. Now, I'm getting back to what happened in the Second World War context. Now, this is literally oil in Persia. This comes through from a platform that I also discovered online known as EBSCO, EBSCO, or whichever one you want to highlight. But it's also one of these online research, hubs. They contain just a lot of, you know, literature on it of knowledge that happened on a specific subject matter. Now, this particular sub, they would call it like a sub category of the discussion of modern petroleum usage and applications. Now, here they note that the discovery of oil in Persia, which is now modern day Iran, happened in 1908, and it marked a significant turning point in the region's economic and political landscape. Because, as you can remember, with much of the oil discovery and much of the oil technological developments, obviously the refining and the patents and stuff, much of the things happened between Russia or the Russian Empire up to, you know, North America. But nothing much was happening here in the ancient world, specifically from, when I say ancient world, it's literally where much of the earlier civilizations were present, that being Persia, that being Iraq, but Iraq was part of Persia back then. And so on here in the Middle East, because it seemed like, you know, there was a loss of the knowledge that they once had, you know, developed you know, they just didn't lead forward from it. Now, the process began when a gentleman by the name of Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, who was from the Qajar dynasty, that's now the king at the time of the Persians, sold exploration rights to a guy by the name of William Knox Darcy, a wealthy Englishman. Now, despite initial challenges, including harsh weather and a lack of skilled labor, Darcy's venture actually bore fruit when oil was struck at Masjid Suleiman, this is the site's name, leading to the establishment of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1909. Now, this discovery also attracted the British government's interest, especially as the internal combustion engine started gaining importance and the further integration of Persian oil into the global markets. Now, the geopolitical implications of this find were definitely profound because as both Russia and Britain sought to protect their interests in Persia during the First World War. Now, remember, Imperial Russia later on collapsed in the First World War because of the Bolshevik Revolution. The Bolshevik Revolution technically were the pure communists, you know, of the discussion. If you had to look actually at that revolution itself, which actually led to the establishment of the USSR, there were like three governments before the actual formation of the Soviets, of the Soviet Union. So the Bolsheviks were sort of like the Lenin guys, the Lenin thugs. And then there was a gap where there was another bunch of guys who were trying to set the scene and be the government. And then there was the actual Soviet Union, you know, sort of like the consolidation of everything to establish the Soviet Union. Now, remember, that is literally after the particular interests that the Russian Empire tried to maintain as the start of the First World War was happening. So, what were we looking at? Now, subsequent developments included efforts by local leaders such as the current, not the current, but at that time, this was the current king of Persia, Reza Khan, who wanted to negotiate better terms for oil profits. This is obviously understanding the situation, specifically what Namibia also suffers from, you know, how to renegotiate a scenario of better, you know, better returns from this local resource. Now, this was to obviously reflect the growing nationalistic sentiment that was obviously taking hold of this new resource. This historical moment also laid the foundation for Iran's complex relationship with the Western powers and even foreign powers, particularly regarding oil control, which continued to evolve through the 20th century. This culminated in significant political upheaval as well, including the 1979 revolution, and the discovery of oil also has not only transformed Persia's economy, but also political dynamics and its international relations. Now, there's an important thing also to note here, dear listeners, because during the Second World War specifically, the British and the Russians actually invaded Persia at the time, which was known as, which is now known as Iran. And this happened in 1949. This is from my second, or one of my multiple literature resources in front of me. So in
19... Yo tadi kukwathere opogoro kara uwasira ya kweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Haiganjua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo yo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na kene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko igena sha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano gopama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kuume mekoe ninge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo nkene una okuya kwathera nokuya pa eabidido yiri monjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere ounji nakene unokara uishangitha tarirapo epanja yao yo nhp.com.na epango na maradura sano odo dina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
So coming back there, dear listeners, from the quick break, and obviously that's as sort of like caught off a little bit offside there, or off guard, but I'll use offside as well, since you know, I'm not gonna punch the Arsenal fans or punch down on them, because literally I just wrote something now just because there is one person, an acquaintance that I know, who's continually posting everything Arsenal related, and I just wrote there in response to her basically saying, listen, it seems like the Arsenal fans are the only people who are trying to make it seem as if they invented football, and not even the Liverpool fans are. Were as bad as them, because the Liverpool fans actually, you know, they knew they were the trendsetters in terms of the English football scene, you know, in terms of being winning a lot of trophies, a lot of European trophies, a lot of league titles, well, before the Premier League, and a lot of particular, you know, cup competitions. And they weren't even like that. But anyway, getting back to where we left off specifically, just to round off this morning's my Sunday morning take. Now, the developments that I referenced in terms of where the British and the Russians invaded Persia before it became Iran in the Second World War was based upon a bunch of an accumulation of events, or basically as a bunch of events were happening. So this discussion that we've even been talking about here in like Namibia, the involvement of local content, the minerals beneficiation, how does that achieved, which both, the second one, minerals beneficiation, basically speaks towards trickle-down economics, which is not something that has actually worked. I mean, if it doesn't work in the leading economies like the UK, it won't work in an economy like Namibia. The only particular aspect that actually does work is if the sovereign wealth fund of the country, which exists, Velvicia, plays an active role in terms of espousing or dispensing literally annually what they call that universal basic income grant mechanism to the Namibian population across the board. That's the only way specifically. Now, in 1908, the month of March, after years of difficult conditions and failure, the geologist, as mentioned, George Bernard Reynolds, discovered oil in Persia, which is modern-day Iran. Now, a year later, 1909, an oil company in the UK, Burma Oil, created a subsidiary company to develop oil production in Persia, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which started volume production of oil by 1913. Now, Britain's Royal Navy was then under the leadership of Winston Churchill, who wanted to shift its fuel source from coal to oil. The Navy thus became the company's major customer and a de facto hidden power behind its success, meaning the British Royal Navy was busy buying directly oil from this company. So this company was basically, you know, selling to the British Navy, which, in the modern day understanding, shouldn't be a problem even for like a Namibian context. I'm not wading into anything that's currently on the table in a legal context in Namibia, but it seems like the underlying or the underpinning perception in Namibia is that activities of the state should be separate from activities of the private sector, which is not always the case, because the state does procure a lot of services and products from the private sector. And it's actually the prerogative of the private sector to basically to be, you know, continuously investing in their business operations in order to bring forward the best new informations and stuff. We obviously see the latest developments popping up in terms of, okay, not latest developments, but the development specifically of what happened in Iran, with the Iranian popular opposition obviously picking up. And there's popular opposition leading to the Anglo-Persian oil company's royalty terms being disputed. And this particular disputing activity was a result of the percentage that the Iranian government actually enjoyed. So they only received like a 16%, the Persian government at the time. And that's where much of this particular dispute happened. Now remember, this is all before the Second World War. Now it created further political discontent throughout the country. And by 1941, everything takes a significant turn because things get a little bit touchy and it gets severe. Now remember, Russia is not pretty far. The Soviet Union is literally bordering onto Iran at the time, because the countries today that border onto Iran, the Kazakhstans, the Tajikistans, the Kyrgyzstan, what's the other one's name? Azerbaijan. They form part, and Georgia, they form part of this territory, which is now known as the Caucasus. Geographically, it's known as the Caucasus. That particular territory lies there, and it's part of the Soviet Union. And basically, Iran is just below them. So this obviously made it easy for the USSR and the British to invade, to invade Persia at the time. So in 1941, after this height of discontent, the Second World War, or during the Second World War, the British and the USSR, the Soviet Union, invaded Iran. They exiled the king at the time, Reza Shah, and then reinstalled another relative of the king, actually his son, who was friendlier to their interests, onto the throne. Now, following the Second World War, nationalistic sentiments were once again on the rise in the Middle East. And this is when the Iranian people, under a democratic system, voted in Mohammad Mossadegh, where Mossadegh was actually championing the nationalization of the resource for the better, the improved beneficiation ultimately from said particular development. Now, or from the said particular oil resource. Now, this is at the same time that if you can call it a scenario in terms of what happened after Mossadegh was voted into power, was that this actually led to another oil crisis. Actually, it was an oil crisis that happened in the 1953 scenario. It was known as the Abadan crisis. But the British were trying to directly, politically, as a government, like what they almost did with the Egyptians with the Suez Canal crisis, is that the British were trying to subvert Mossadegh directly as a government. Thus, this is where the actual claim comes through. They then instigated the British and the American intelligence, because now I see the American intelligence also present there, to actually orchestrate things in order to overthrow Mossadegh. And then they brought back the very royal, the Iranian royal, Reza Pahlavi, who was used to replace his own father. Remember, Reza Shah was the father of Reza Pahlavi. Reza Shah was trying to champion his nation's rights towards the British, interests. And then the British and the Russians invaded. And then they replaced the Iranian king with the son, with his son, which is a bit of a humiliation, but yeah. Let me first get this caller's contribution through before I end the discussion. Eagle FM, good morning.
Oh, morning, Dwight. Hi. How are you?
Good morning, Angabona. How are you doing?
Cool, man.
Mm.
It's a bit cold.
Yeah, it is cold, Angabona.
Oh, now you have really gone into historical perspective of issues of oil and oil discoveries and many, many other things. And then I just found myself, this is the new information that I'm hearing.
Man,
from the way the Chinese started and all this other poll.
Because it's important, Angabona, because, I mean, how is it, Angabona, that I can't seem to understand where we've not used oil in a southern hemisphere context. And then if you look it up, you discover, oh, but because the resource was more easily discoverable in the northern hemisphere, the civilizations back then used it for their basic needs back then, like they needed lamp oil.
Oh, my friend, that no wonder why they always say, yes, the case can be a case or a blessing.
Yeah.
It's because we have seen what has been happening in the world. But that means now that during those world war that you were talking about, the one that we are in now, it hasn't yet reached the level of being called the Third World War, or
it's boiling at that point. It's boiling at that point. The reason why I'm saying so is because at least you see the world leaders of the world superpowers talking to each other. So Trump and Xi has met, Putin and Xi has met, the European Union and Xi have met last year. Who else is there? There's another, what's the guy from Canada? Mark Carney. He has met Xi. He has met Modi. He has met these Australian, the guys from Australia, the guy from Australia and the guy from New Zealand. And then Modi has gone to meet Trump right now, like this, I think this, like last, just after he met Xi Jinping. Trump had to fly back to meet Modi in Washington. So at least we see the world's biggest economies, the world's largest clusters of financial heavyweights of the world are meeting and talking to each other, which is technically the G20 or the G7. No, yeah, the G7 plus. Let me say that.
The G7 is where Ramaphosa was invited.
That's the G20. Because this year's G20 summit was in the United States, and Trump doesn't want Ramaphosa to go there. And last year, the G20 summit was in South Africa, and Trump didn't want to go to the G20 summit. So the G7, Angabona, always happens before the G20. The G7 is the world's top seven economies, and the G20 includes the other 20 economies. The other 13 economies like South Africa, Russia, China, India, Australia, and New Zealand. And those guys then, and the EU, yes. And then they talk about the economic, direction that the world should take, which is a little bit of a hijacking situation, if you ask me, Angabona.
Yeah.
Because it basically hijacks the economic direction outside of the UN perspective.
Yeah. Now that those blocks, those groupings, that they are working on their own, even though there is some connectivity or in the relationship among themselves. So, and you see the BRICS here, you see the G20, G7 and all these other things. They are all pursuing towards their interests, different interests. But when are they going to ensure that, yes, these blocks, this other one, can really cooperate and collaborate in addressing the world's challenges?
Well,
especially, I remember way after the G20 in South Africa, immediately when those declarations were pronounced, Trump came in and immediately said, no, we are not going to promote. We are against this social inclusion. And the social inclusion, when you look at it, it talks about at least inequalities, issues of having access to resources, especially to this multinational cooperation companies. How do you call them again? Multinational companies.
Yeah, MNCs.
Especially those IMF and all those, the World Bank. And these are the people who are actually their policies and programming have not been in favor of most of our countries here. So in terms of giving them loans, there's a lot of strings, conditions attached. And now when they see that the G20, because I'm also talking about this BRICS that is now emerging so greatly. So you see many countries have applied and they are still going to be accorded their status, the admission. And the way I'm seeing it, when you mention about these leaders of this global power, and I don't see, and I see again that the Americans, Trump is still thinking about the invasion and getting in there. Well, you're not the one who was telling us that it was France. You say they are now mobilized, that everyone must be prepared. They were trained, giving some, arms,
Yeah.
And they believe AK-47 is number one there. So now, how do you look at it? Even if it's their behaviors toward, seem to be, moving that direction.
Mass mobilization of warfare.
Now, if you think issues of that nature, when is this war, the current war that is taking place now, and the Israel has started bombing people there?
And that's why I said, Angabona, it's boiling, but then you see the opposite. The guys are flying to each other, or the guys are talking to each other, or they're flying to China, talking to China, or they fly to Trump, and then they try to talk to Trump. I will explain to you, Angabona, which is the sort of like the dilemma we in the world face, is that these global leaders will go and say one thing to each other, with each other, before meeting each other, and even after meeting each other. But then they start bombing, or they start attacking, or they commence, or they continue. Yeah, their actions, or the country, the actions of their countries literally contradict the actions of the words, or the meaning of the words they just give you. So basically they give you empty words, which is also one of the ways in which, no one can actually take the sort of like, and this is most the one thing, Angabona, where they love using the world order. There's this label. Have you ever noticed, Angabona, the NATO guys would come and tell you about global order. What's that other word? International order. Yeah. They would come and use this word, international order. I spoke about it last...
Unipolar. Tell me, please, explain to me this...
Unipolar.
Unipolar. And this is actually one thing that the world, especially the East, the Russian, then most of the global leaders also.
Yeah.
They are talking about now...
multipolar. Yeah, they mean multipolar, but multilateralism means a country like Namibia with its 3 million Namibians can actually talk on the level with a country like Russia, which is currently happening, Angabona.
Good.
Also on the level specifically, you see a country like Namibia can engage on a level directly with China. So we don't have to work through the AU to talk to China, or through the AU to talk to Russia. Now, this unipolar discussion technically sets that specific situation, or the other word that I used, international order. Now, I love listening to the, like I said multiple times, the central, the neutral historians and the neutral economists, because they all will say, now a country like Namibia can now say in a multipolar setting, can now promote its interests not being told at the UN General Assembly, because you are Namibia, you are insignificant. Please, we don't have to listen to you. You don't have issues.
Issues of that nature. And this is the attitude of Trump. Even if, though he is now saying he took all his top class in terms of business, they must, what is it? This Elon Musk.
Yeah.
All those guys, I could see them there.
Yeah.
And they are talking about cooperation.
And I don't know why, I don't know why he took those guys, mainly the tech CEOs, Uncle Bono, because he went and spoke, apparently much of the trade discussions between Trump and Xi was based upon soybeans, agricultural products.
Yeah.
Was mostly agricultural products and agricultural trade.
So immediately after that, the president of China, they condemned the thinking of Trump toward China.
Mm.
I mean, not China, but Cuba.
Mm.
And they were all condemning that one and things like that. And when I listened to Trump again, his own is not really the threat, because he was talking about, you know, people now who are paying money, they are living, they are the one who are paying tax. So now we are looking at the immigration and the immigrants.
Yeah.
So now issues of that nature, I'm just thinking that we also need to, as we talk about this globalization, the world has become one village, things like that. People should really move in accordance with the laws, the values that you people put there. It's not necessarily that you are excluding some, but things must be done properly, documented.
Personally for me, I would love the world just to be a little bit more peaceful. That's what I want to see.
Yes.
Because my concern is, Uncle Bona, we as Namibia, we are very much exposed to developments that we are not in control of, which is not a nice thing to be, specifically if you're Namibia. And I actually want also to see, you know, the AU guys, us the Africans across the board, actually work a lot closer with each other instead of this rubbish of, you know, Kenya going to talk one side. They have a different face when they talk somewhere else. And then Kenya goes and speaks on behalf of AU. And then AU doesn't agree with anything that Kenya does. And then the AU just drags his feet, because that's what the AU basically is doing. It keeps dragging its feet. And that's also not a good thing, Uncle Bona, because if we have the best template, which is the EU, which can literally talk as one, when the EU shows up, Uncle Bona, it's 27 nations trading now directly with Namibia. 27 nations, Uncle Bona. How unfair do you think that negotiation process is if 27 nations pool their resources together and Namibia is showing up there with just its own singular little voice against 27, an economy of 27 economies?
Imagine. That's why we also need to seriously unify our voice here and they speak with one voice.
We have
because
to.
The challenge is for us, they are so massive. Unemployment.
Yeah.
And we have a lot to give to the world.
Yeah.
In terms of human capacity.
We have the resources. We will have the labor of the future. We will still have the best tourism to offer. Okay, not the best, because South Africa has some nice stuff. But we will still be able to give things, Uncle Bona. And it'll be up until 2100 when they are predicting humanity's, you know, our population decline will actually like fall off the charts. Then we won't be having babies anymore.
So, and you see, and that is what I'm seeing. Because you see, when you development, the population, and that's why you are saying that we might not have a better share in terms of negotiation.
Yeah.
the small population is also disadvantaging us.
No, for us, for us it's fine, Angabona. For us it's fine, but we are now in a template. I'm sorry to just block you there, Angabona, but if you look at as a small population as Namibia, it works for us.
Yes.
It literally works for us. What we are missing, Angabona, is actually just putting words in action to actually achieve our own development goals. We won't even need the SDGs, but since we love participating in themes, I've also seen our government loves participating in these international themes of a theme here and a theme there and a theme there, but the theme never.
Because we are ascribed to that. We are ascribed to some of this imposition, the kind of imposition. And obviously, we are to ascribe to these international values and norms. And if we don't maybe rectify, of course, we need to scrutinize, to examine
scrutinize,
properly.
Yeah. No, I'm going to scrutinize.
You know, those kind of scrutinize.
Yeah.
So, and then we now see, okay, well, so that we don't really negotiate and bargain in bad faith.
Yeah.
But obviously, we just to ascribe. And we see those that we know that are not working for us, like you are saying, at least we put them aside. But the issue is, most of those international instruments that we are, you know,
part two.
Mm. So, you know, that's also another corner. There's
it
no
is.
Way you can escape about it.
It is.
So, except that, yes, in terms of really having a proper channel of communication, because we have got this SADC is there, this other one is there to talk to the AUN and all this other thing. But we have been talking, even in those kind of reforms.
Exactly.
But people don't want to do that.
Exactly.
Whenever they want to go to war, they just bulldoze their way.
Exactly,
in.
Exactly.
So those are some. I also want to agree that, yes, what you want is peace. It's peace globally, it's peace everywhere. So I think, Dwight, I just love the perspective that you began with. How you are telling us about some of these resources and the people who had their hands on it. So please, when we are getting ours, we don't want ours to be a case, and let them not turn it to be a case, because they are the one who usually influence and all these things and even threaten our leaders.
Mm.
So like they did. So we don't want those kind of things, and we are happy that they all went to China. Let's see how they will now translate what they have discussed. So for China and Russia, their strategy in security and everything, they are good partners. And they are also showing the world that, yes, they are good, really partners.
Mm.
Trump, fine. So I think he will repent very soon as well. Completely repent then.
Angabona, we have to get through this year. We have to see what is the next 3 years of Trump's term, because many of the academics and the thinkers and the analysts are citing that we have to look at what's going to happen in their local, it's a local elections happening there, a local authority elections there in the US, and it's about seeing how the voters in America will react to the policies since last year up until now that have impacted their lives. So if Trump comes out strong, he's got a sound base, he will have more motivation to continue what he's currently doing. If there's going to be a negative reaction, Angabona, the potential is that there might be steps of impeachment being taken against him for whatever reasons, for the accusations of corruption facing him and his cronies specifically. So
Those allegations have been going on. They were even also looking at the constitution and the law.
No, these are new ones. These are new ones, Angabona. These are new ones. Yeah, these are ones. Apparently, there's a story that came out in this past week, of $2 billion US dollars that was literally siphoned away from government to pay for allies, political allies. Just like that, $2 billion. You know, the stories that you hear about Angabona here in an African context, Trump has literally been doing that in an American context. So if you think corruption is just an African thing, Trump is exactly doing what you would expect an African leader to do. So, so there are things happening there, but obviously, the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General is now, is a guy that is a former personal lawyer of Trump. So things will become weird because political interference has never been higher than I've seen currently. And I try not to pay attention, Ankabona, to internal American affairs. But for some reason, the Europeans, they, or some of the, you know, international media that I sometimes look forward to specifically to stay abreast of what the EU is doing, because the EU and China and South Africa are now our biggest trade partners today.
Yeah.
We have to know what's happening in the EU and in China and in South Africa in order to understand what will impact us. But then every time there's always something that they talk about Trump and Trump's antics, and I'm just like, I doch, guys, just let the Americans deal with the guy. It, you know, we know now we've got tariffs and stuff. Just let him, let them deal with him.
Listen, before I go, you are making me laugh. You. Before I go, yeah, what I wanted to say is we were talking about the impeachment and all these other things.
Mm.
So now the separation of power in those countries, because I know many a times here I see analysis talking about the executive interfering into legislature, legislative, you know, those legislative houses.
Executive, legislative, and
yes.
What's the other one?
Yeah. So, the judicial one. Yeah. But let's leave it about the judicial. But now the relationship that they are always worried about is the executive and the legislative branch.
Mm.
Now, you remember when they were saying that about the oil and all these other things?
Mm.
And when you now look at what they are doing there, in America, of course, you know, they don't respect these international norms.
Yeah.
Norms. Those ones they don't.
It's actually the British Ankabona, but yeah, you are right.
But you can see the interference of the executive and the legislative branch in America. So much. So much. And that's why it's bullied. It's just forcing his way, and when they come here, they condemn South Africa, no, this genocide, this what. But, is this not a double, how do you call it?
A double standard.
Hypocrisy. Yeah, it's a double standard.
Yeah, it's hypocrisy and double standard. Well, you're right in both.
So, Edward, I think we have taken too long and I have learned a lot. Thank you very much for the interaction and the opportunity that you have accorded to me.
Not a problem, Angabona.
So that you can learn better.
Yep, not a problem.
All the best.
All the best, Angabona.
But, Alan, sorry, before you go.
Mm.
During the your partnership with the comedian.
On Friday.
Is it only on Friday? But you do start from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday until Friday, isn't it?
No, Angabona. The message as I carried over, like you and Mandume shared, because both of you highlighted that
Mandume also shared the same thing.
He shared the same thing on Friday. So both of you have highlighted, you know, a strong concern with you know. Not having the opportunity of participating in the 4 o'clock program, the home run. So I shared it, and specifically we are now actively, you know, highlighting there's the opportunity. We set it between 4:30 and 5:30. It's like a full hour, a window. After that, we have to give like our closing arguments or closing discussion points, and the introduction points at the start. But in between there, in the middle, where we've got the advertising and all that.
Yeah. So we are also going to do our own thing. We should also look at ourselves. I'm talking about myself. And so thank you very much. Thank you very much for understanding our concern.
Not a problem, Angabona.
So, Nejit, I believe it was a bit legitimate. Not necessary that you want to pressurize the leadership and management yourself there. And, you know, sometimes these are some of the things that sometimes they put leaders leaders at the corner. And issues of that nature, for you, I know you are, how do you say it? You are a liberal.
I am a liberal, Angabona, and I've also, which is not a little bit, but it's not a liberal field, but I've also worked in customer service. So I actually listen. When someone when someone says they have a concern, customer service is not about being having a political disposition or, you know, something in the character. Customer service dictates if there is a stakeholder who you technically rely on, the stakeholder's concerns must be listened to. And then you have to give or do something to actually try and improve on that feedback. Or you actually work to give feedback for that stakeholder.
Yes, I remember those years you used to give us some issues, some areas of custom management relationship and all the areas.
We have to end.
Bye. Thanks.
See you again.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Have a blessed day.
You too, Angabona. Bye-bye.
Good.
On that note, dear listeners, we do end up on our discussion, which I've actually eaten a lot of time. But stay tuned for the next program to follow on after the break. We'll see each other again, same time, same place next week or during the course of the week, where myself and Helmut will be on the home run specifically, where we bring you the insightful engagements and the context that you sometimes missed in the broader sense. On that note, stay tuned for the next program. This has been my Sunday Morning Take with a little bit of extra time. And we'll be back next week, same time, same place again.